Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we are heading to a place that I think it occupies a very specific, almost confusing space in the modern brain. It's a place that usually just gets reduced to a bumper sticker.
The happiest place on earth.
Exactly. Or the last Shangri-La. We are talking about Bhutan. And I'll be honest, before we started prepping for this, my mental image of Bhutan was, pretty two-dimensional. I pictured monks smiling, big mountains, and maybe just a vague sense of mystical peace.
Which is sort of the Disneyfied version of the Himalayas, right?
Right, but then you read the actual history, specifically Dr. Karma Phunt Show's massive definitive work, The History of Bhutan, and you realize that peace is, it's the wrong word.
Oh, completely.
This is a country forged in fire. It's a story of warlords, sorcery, civil war, and a 50-year conspiracy to hide a dead body.
It is, and I've said this before, it's Game of Thrones, but with more yak butter tea and, maybe slightly better morals.
Slightly, and look, we aren't just parsing this text as academics today. We're wearing our professional hats. We're speaking as the team behind Best of Bhutan Tours. And I want to set the stakes here. Why does a potential traveler need to know about 17th century Tibetan warlords to enjoy a vacation in 2026?
Because Bhutan is what you'd call a high context culture. That's the polite way of saying it.
Okay, what's the blunt way?
The blunt way is if you go to Bhutan without doing the reading, you are just looking at pretty rocks. We operate Best of Bhutan Tours on a very specific philosophy. We don't sell sightseeing, we sell understanding. When you stand in a dzong, which is a fortress, you need to know why the walls are slanted. You need to know why there's a painting of a man hitting a demon with a phallus on the wall.
We will definitely get to the penis paintings.
We have to, it's essential. But the point is, this deep dive is the software you need to install in your brain before you get on the plane. If you understand the history, the landscape comes alive.
And if you don't, it's just scenery.
It's just scenery.
So let's install that software. We're using Dr. Funcho's book as our source code. It's widely considered the first comprehensive history that blends the traditional Bhutanese perspective, the magic, the myths, with modern rigorous historiography.
Which is a very, very difficult tightrope to
Is that?
walk.
It is. So here's the plan. We're going to start with the hardware, the land itself, and its many, many names.
Okay.
Then we'll look at the operating system, the spiritual conquest of the Himalayas. We'll move to the firewall, the unification and the era of the fortresses. And finally, we'll look at the user interface, the modern monarchy and gross national happiness.
I like the metaphor. Let's see if it holds up.
Let's start with the name, because even the word Bhutan is a bit of a misnomer, isn't it? I mean, it's not what they call themselves.
No, not at all. It's an exonym. Bhutan likely comes from the Sanskrit Bhutanta, which means the end of Tibet.
The end of Tibet.
Yeah, so it literally defines the country by what it isn't. It's the place where Tibet stops.
And Dr. Frenchow opens the book with a really interesting philosophical nugget from the Buddhist logician Dharmakirti about names.
Yes, Dharmakirti said names are like sticks.
Meaning you can beat people with them.
I mean, you could,
Yeah.
but he meant there are tools. A stick doesn't have a will of its own. It goes where the user points it. Names are conventional designations.
So they don't touch the essence of the object.
Exactly. They reflect the mindset of the person doing the naming. And for centuries, the people naming this land were the Tibetans to the north. And they weren't being complimentary.
They called it Loman.
Right. Lo means south. Mon is a term that, well, it implies darkness, barbarism, a lack of culture. So Lomon is the southern land of darkness.
That is harsh. That's like New Yorkers referring to New Jersey as the Shadowlands.
It's worse. I mean, in the Tibetan worldview, they were the center of the civilized universe because they had the Buddhist teachings. The south was a jungle. It was filled with poisonous plants, dangerous beasts, and stubborn people who hadn't been tamed by religion. It was an othering technique, pure and simple.
But the locals, they kind of flipped the script on some of these names. They had their own descriptive titles. My favorite is Menjong.
The land of medicinal herbs.
Now, this isn't just poetry. This is biology.
It is, and this is something we really emphasize on our tours. When we drive you up to the Shelila Pass, which is what, about 4,000 meters up? The air actually smells different. It's sharp, it's herbal. You are surrounded by wild rhubarb, gentian, and hundreds of species that are used in traditional medicine. Historically, Bhutan paid tribute to Tibetan herbs. That was their currency.
And there's a legend about how the herbs got there, right? Involving a Chinese princess.
Princess Wenching. The story goes she was traveling to Tibet to marry the king in the 7th century, and she cast a handful of medicinal seeds into the wind. The north wind carried them down into the valleys of Bhutan. So while Tibet got the high, dry plateau, Bhutan got the lush, green pharmacy.
There's another name that I think is even more evocative, especially when you're actually standing there. Sendin Kopejong.
The country be strewn with cypresses.
Now, for a listener who hasn't been there, cypress might sound like a garden hedge. We need to correct that scale.
We really do. The Bhutan cypress Copressus tuberosa is a monster. We are talking about trees that can grow 80 meters tall with a girth of 14 meters.
That's a skyscraper. A living skyscraper.
It is. When we take guests to the Kirji Lakang Temple in Bumthang, there's a cypress there that is just monumental. You feel so small standing next to it. And in the Bhutanese psyche, these aren't just timber. They are sacred.
They grew from walking staffs.
That's the belief, that they are the walking staffs of great lamas that were planted upside down and grew. They connect the earth to the sky.
But the name that stuck the one on the passport is Drukyul.
Drukyul.
The land of the thunder dragon. Now, I have to play devil's advocate here. This sounds like incredible marketing. Thunder dragon. It sounds like a heavy metal band or a very aggressive sports team. Did someone just sit around a fire and say, what's the coolest animal? A dragon. Let's go with that.
It does sound like a rebrand, doesn't it? But the origin is actually quite specific. And again, it comes from Tibet. It wasn't named after a dragon that lived in Bhutan.
It wasn't.
No, it was named after a sound.
The sound.
In the 12th century, a Tibetan Lama named Tsangpa Gyre was looking for a place to build a monastery in Tibet. He saw 9 dragons fly up into the sky and then heard a loud boom of thunder.
Okay.
In Tibetan belief, thunder is the voice of the dragon. So he took it as an omen. He named his monastery Druk Dragon.
So the Drukpa lineage was born from that.
Exactly. The dragon school of Buddhism. And when that specific school of Buddhism eventually migrated south and unified the valleys of Bhutan, the country took the name of the school.
That is such a crucial distinction. The country is named after the church.
Precisely. It's like if Italy was named Catholic land. It shows you that the identity of the state and the identity of the religion are fused at, you know, the atomic level. You just cannot separate them.
Which brings us to the geography itself. Dr. Fincho calls it the vertical country.
And this is the number one thing our clients at Best of Bhutan Tours struggle to comprehend until they're actually in the car.
Right.
They look at Google Maps. They see 2 towns, Thimphu and Punaka. They're maybe 70 kilometers apart as the crow flies. And they say, oh, an hour's drive.
And the driver just laughs.
The driver laughs for a very long time. It's a 3-hour drive. Because there are no straight lines in Bhutan, the country rises from the Indian plains, basically sea level, to Gangkar Puensum, which is over 7,500 meters high.
Wow.
In a span of about 150 kilometers.
It's a wall. It's not a country. It's a wall.
It's a staircase of deep, V-shaped valleys and massive ridges. And historically, this meant that every valley was its own world.
Separate kingdom, almost.
Almost. Mm. The people in one valley spoke a different dialect than the people in the next valley, because getting there meant crossing a 4,000-meter pass, probably in the snow.
Which explains why unification was such a nightmare, which we will definitely get to. But first, we need to talk about the software, the spiritual taming of this wild, vertical landscape.
This is part 2, the spiritual foundations. And we have to start with the demoness.
The supine demoness. This is one of those stories that just makes you realize how different the Himalayan worldview is from the Western one.
Yeah.
Set the scene for us.
Okay, so it's the 7th century. The Tibetan king, Songtsen Gampo, wants to build temples. But everything he builds collapses.
Thus falls down.
Right. So his geomancers, his feng shui experts, you could say, tell him the problem isn't the soil. The problem is that the entire Himalayan landscape is the literal body of a giant she-demon lying on her back.
So the mountains aren't just mountains. They're her arms, her legs.
They're her limbs, exactly. And she is thrashing around, blocking the flow of auspicious energy. So to build civilization, the king has to pin her down. He initiates this massive project, mm-hmm. 108 temples built in a single day across the Himalayas.
A single day.
That's the legend. And each temple acts as a nail to pin a specific body part.
And Bhutan has 2 of the most important nails.
We do. And these are 2 of the most popular stops on our Best of Bhutan itineraries.
Yeah.
First, there's Kirchu Lahong in Paro. It pins down her left foot.
Her left foot.
And then there's Jampa Lakhong in Bumthang, pinning down her left knee.
When you enter Kirchu Lakhong, and I want to get the sensory details here, it feels ancient.
It feels heavy. That's the word I always use. Mm-hmm. You walk into the inner sanctum, and the floorboards are grooved, literally worn down by centuries of people prostrating. The statue inside, the Jowo, has this intense, penetrating stare. You aren't just visiting a church. You are standing on the architecture of suppression. You're standing on the nail that keeps the chaos at bay.
But pinning the demoness wasn't enough. You needed to convert the local spirits. And this is where the superhero enters the chat.
Guru Rinpoche.
Padmasambhava, the lotus born.
Yes. In the West, we might know the Buddha. But in Bhutan, the Buddha is almost a distant historical figure. Guru Rinpoche is the guy who actually got his hands dirty, the second Buddha.
He's the one who tamed the land. And the most famous example of this is the tiger's nest, Takchang.
Takchang is the image on every travel brochure. A monastery clinging to a cliff 900 meters above the valley floor. It looks physically impossible.
The legend says he flew there on a tigress.
Yes. But let's go deeper than the flying tiger headline. Why did he go there? He didn't go there to have a nice view. He went there because it was a power spot inhabited by a demon named Singhi Samdrup.
Okay.
And to deal with this demon, Guru Rinpoche assumed a wrathful form, Dorje Drolo.
What's a wrathful form look like? I'm picturing something pretty intense.
Terrifying. Fangs, bulging eyes, riding a tigress surrounded by flames. He had to become scarier than the demon to subdue the demon.
That is a profound psychological insight. You can't just nice guy your way out of chaos.
Exactly. He tamed the demon and forced it to take an oath to protect the Dharma. So when you hike up to Tiger's Nest with us, and it is a hike, let me tell you, your calves will burn.
Oh, I remember.
You are retracing a battle. You are walking up into the tiger's lair to see where the raw, chaotic energy of the land was transmuted into spirituality.
Okay, we have the demoness, we have the wrathful guru. Now we have to talk about the character who I think confuses our guests the most.
Ah, yes.
The divine madman, Drukpa Kunli.
The reason for the phalluses.
Let's just put it out there. You walk through a village in Bhutan, near Punaka especially, and there are giant, vivid, often ejaculating penises painted on the walls of the houses.
6 feet tall, sometimes with eyes, sometimes with a little ribbon tied around them.
And the Western tourist stands there and goes, ugh. Is this a fertility clinic? Is this some kind of protest graffiti?
And we have to explain. No. This is a security system.
Explain that.
Yeah.
How is a giant phallus a security system?
It goes back to Drukpa Kunli, a 15th century saint. He belonged to the crazy wisdom tradition. The idea is that conventional social norms, you know, politeness, celibacy, sobriety, are actually traps for the ego.
They make you fake?
They make you fake. To find the truth, you have to smash the norms.
So he was a drunk.
He drank. He slept around. Yeah. He mocked the high abbots. He famously used his penis, which he called his flaming thunderbolt of wisdom.
Of course he did.
To subdue demonesses.
Hit them with it.
The texts are a bit vague, but it seems he merged with them. He weaponized sexuality to shock people into enlightenment and to subdue negative spirits.
So the painting on the wall is a talisman. It's a ward.
It's a beware of dog sign for evil spirits. It basically says the power of the divine madman is here. Stay away.
Does the modern generation still buy this? Or do the teenagers just roll their eyes?
That is a great question. And there is a bit of friction there. You know, you talk to a 16-year-old in Thimphu and they might find it a bit cringe, as they say, but they wouldn't dare paint over it. It's part of the cultural DNA. It represents a spirituality that is earthy, humorous, and real, not just high-minded philosophy.
Speaking of real, let's move to the treasure hunter.
Pema Lingpa.
The Tertön, the treasure revealer.
This concept is wild to me. The idea that Guru Rinpoche hid time capsules all over Bhutan in the 8th century, just waiting to be found later.
Exactly. Physical texts, statues, ritual objects. He hid them in rocks, in lakes, in the sky. He predicted that in the future, when the time is right, a specific person will find this. And Pema Lingpa was the greatest of these revealers.
And his most famous discovery happened at Mbabartcho, the Burning Lake.
This is a story I love telling when we were actually standing by the water. The year is roughly 1475. Pema Lingpa claims there is treasure at the bottom of this deep river pool.
Okay.
The local governor thinks he's a fraud. A massive crowd gathers to watch him fail.
So the pressure is on. The pressure is definitely on. Pema Lingpa holds a lit butter lamp in his hand. He says, if I'm a fake, may I die in this water. If I am true, may I return with the treasure and this lamp still burning. And he jumps in.
Into this raging cold river.
He disappears. The crowd holds its breath. Minutes pass. Then he breaks the surface, and he's holding a chest of treasure, and the lamp in his hand is still burning.
That is a cinematic moment. You can't write that.
It solidified his legacy. And this isn't just a fairy tale. The current royal family of Bhutan traces their direct bloodline back to Pina Lingpa. His DNA provides the spiritual legitimacy for the monarchy today.
So we have the stage set. We have the land, the spirits, the lineage, but we don't have a country yet. We have a bunch of valleys fighting each other. This brings us to part three, the unification.
Into the Zabdrung, Gawang Namyo, the bearded man you see in every single temple, usually sitting right next to the Buddha.
He arrived in 1616 from Tibet, but he didn't come as a conqueror initially. He came as a refugee.
A refugee with a very specific and very important piece of luggage.
The vertebrae.
Yes, the Ranjong Karzapani. This was a self-created image of the Bodhisattva of compassion that appeared in the vertebrae of his ancestor after cremation.
Wait, self-created? How does that work?
The belief is that the bone naturally formed into the shape of the deity. It wasn't carved. This made it a relic of supreme power. It was the crown jewels of the Drukpa lineage.
And the ruler of Tibet wanted it.
Desperately. Zabdrung refused to give it up. War was imminent, so he fled south to Bhutan.
And the Tibetans didn't just let him go, they followed him.
For the next few decades, Bhutan was under constant threat. Tibetan armies invaded again and again to get that bone back. And this is where Zabdrung transforms from a monk into a statesman.
Right.
He realizes he can't just meditate, he needs to build a state.
So he builds the zongs.
The fortresses.
When you see a zong like Punaka or Thimphu, it's not just a castle, it's massive. Slanted walls, towering central keeps, they're intimidating.
And built without a single nail. It's a system of interlocking wood and rammed earth. They're engineering marvels. But functionally, Zabdrung used them to institute the dual system.
This is the core mechanic of the Bhutanese state. Explain the dual system.
It's called Cho Sidni. Cho is religion, Sid is politics. Zabdrung created a government with two heads. He appointed a Jikenpo to look after the monastic body, what he called the silken knot that binds gently.
Right.
And he appointed a Desi to look after the civil laws, taxes, and war, the golden yoke that weighs heavy.
So he split the church and state, but housed them in the same building?
Yeah, and even today, if you go to Tashicho Dzong in Thimphu, one half is the monk body, and the other half is the king's office and the parliament. It's a physical manifestation of that 17th century idea.
Let's talk about Punaka Dzong specifically, the Palace of Great Bliss, because there's a legend about the architect there that just fits our theme perfectly.
The architect, Zoe Palop, Zabdrung told him to build a Dzong that would surpass all others, but he didn't give him blueprints.
No blueprints for a building that big.
No. Instead, through spiritual power, he sent the architect's consciousness to the copper-colored mountain, the paradise of Guru Rinpoche.
An astral projection field trip.
Precisely. The architect studied the celestial palace in the dream, memorized the layout, woke up, and built Punaka Dzong to match. That's why it's considered the most beautiful building in the country. It's supposed to be a copy of heaven.
But the reality of the time was hellish. The war with Tibet was brutal. The source mentions Zabdrung using magic warfare.
Yeah, it wasn't just arrows and swords. There are records of Zabdrung performing terrifying tantric rituals to summon protective deities. We have accounts of Tibetan armies getting lost in sudden thick fogs or being struck by unexplained illnesses.
So he was the magician king.
In every sense of the word.
Yeah.
And he won. He unified the country. But then in 1651, he died. And this leads to my absolute favorite part of the book, the hoax. The hoax of the retreat. This is one of the greatest conspiracies in political history. I'm not exaggerating.
Zabdrung dies, but his son is sickly. The state is fragile. The Tibetans are just waiting for a moment of weakness to attack. So the inner circle makes a decision.
We don't tell anyone.
They just pretend he's alive.
They announced that the Zabdrung had entered a strict long-term meditation retreat and could not be disturbed.
For how long? A year? 2 years?
50.
Years?
50? No.
50. Imagine the logistics. It's insane.
How do you possibly pull that off?
You have to serve meals to a closed door every single day for half a century. You have to play ceremonial music outside the room to pretend he's in there doing rituals.
But didn't people get suspicious? Hey, the boss hasn't been seen in 20 years.
Of course. Rumors flew. But the inner circle, the Desi, maintained the charade with iron discipline. They even issued laws and edicts claiming they were signed by the Zabdrung.
The guy behind the curtain says to raise taxes.
Exactly that. They even fooled foreign dignitaries. There are records of Mughal emissaries from India visiting and being told, oh, the great Lama is meditating, but here is a blessing cord he just nodded for you. It's Weekend at Bernie's meets geopolitics. It's unbelievable.
It is. But eventually, of course, it fell apart. And when The Secret came out, combined with a lack of a clear heir, Bhutan plunged into chaos. And this brings us to the Dark Ages, the civil wars.
Dr. Finchow describes the 19th century as a time of just absolute treachery.
It was a vacuum of power. You had the Black Regent, a Desi who assassinated his rivals and plunged the country into strife. You had the regional governors, the Penlops, all fighting each other for control. It was constant low-level warfare.
And this is such important context because when we talk about the monarchy today, some Westerners might think, oh, an oppressive king. But in the Bhutanese context, the monarchy was the solution to the chaos.
It was the lifeboat. By the late 1800s, people were just exhausted. And then enter Ugyen Wangchuck.
The Penlop of Trongsa.
He was a brilliant strategist. He defeated his rivals in battle. But he also, you know, looked at the map. He saw the British Empire in India, the Raj rising in power. And he saw Tibet and China weakening. He made a calculated pivot.
He bet on the South.
He mediated between the British and Tibetans. He earned the title of Knight Commander of the Indian Empire. And in 1907, he called a grand assembly at Phnom Penh.
And they elected him king.
Unanimously. The monks, the officials, the local chiefs, they signed the Oath of Allegiance. This ended the dual system of reincarnations and civil administrators. It created a hereditary monarchy. And for the first time in a century, stability returned.
This starts the modern era. And we can jump forward to the third king, Jigme Dorje Wangchuck. He's called the father of modern Bhutan.
He is the one who opened the door. You have to realize, until the 1960s, Bhutan had no roads, no paper currency, no postal system. If you wanted to send a message, you literally sent a runner.
And he changed all of that.
He saw China take over Tibet in 1959, and he realized isolation was no longer a defense, it was a vulnerability. He built the first road from India to Thimphu. It used to take 6 days on a mule. Suddenly, it took 6 hours in a jeep.
That's a huge change. He also abolished slavery, right?
In 1958. It's a shock to realize serfdom existed that late, but he wiped it out. He gave the serfs land and citizenship. He essentially dragged the country into the 20th century.
And then his son, the fourth king, did something even more radical. He gave away the ultimate power.
This is the story that always baffles political scientists. The fourth king, in the early 2000s, decided that absolute monarchy was fundamentally flawed. He said, you can have a good king, but what if the next one is bad? The system must be bigger than the man.
So he proposed democracy, and the people protested.
They protested against democracy. They were terrified. They looked at the politics in Nepal or India, the corruption, the infighting, and said, we don't want that. We want you.
So the king had to campaign for his own unemployment.
Basically. He toured the districts, explaining that it was their duty to take the power. He forced them to draft a constitution. Then he abdicated in 2006 to let his son, the fifth king, oversee the first elections in 2008.
That's a unique transition of power. But the fourth king is famous for something else. A phrase that went global.
Gross national happiness.
GNH, it's a great brand. But we need to dig into the mechanics of it. Is it just a slogan, don't worry, be happy?
No. And Dr. Funcho is very clear on this. It's not a mood. It's a metric. It's a technocratic screening tool for development.
So how does it work, practically?
Well, the Center for Bhutan Studies conducts a massive census. And they ask incredibly specific questions. How many hours did you sleep last night? Do you trust your neighbors? How often do you recite prayers?
Do you feel safe walking alone at night? Things like that.
Exactly. They measure 9 domains. Psychological well-being, health, education, time use, cultural diversity, good governance, community vitality, ecological resilience, and living standards.
Time use is the one that always hits me. I mean, in the West, if you work 80 hours a week and make $1 million, you are a success.
You're on the cover of a magazine.
Right. But in the GNH model, you are failing because you have time poverty.
Precisely. If a government policy increases wealth but destroys leisure time or community bonds, it gets rejected.
But, and here comes the skepticism, does it actually work? Or is it a way to, you know, dress up poverty and say it's okay?
That is the criticism.
Yeah.
And the book is honest about the friction. Bhutan has youth unemployment. It has a brain drain. Thousands of young, educated Bhutanese are moving to Australia to work in service jobs because the economy in Bhutan is just too small.
So they are trading GNH for GDP.
They are. And this brings us to the plastic era, the clash, the modern reality.
This is what our guests see the moment they land. You see a monk in crimson robes spinning a prayer wheel and checking TikTok on an iPhone 15.
You see biodegradable offerings wrapped in plastic bags littering the trails. You see the ancient zongs juxtaposed with concrete apartment blocks.
Dr. Funchow calls this diachronic living.
Living in two times at once. 1 foot in the medieval past and 1 foot in the digital future. And honestly, this is the best of Bhutan Tour's value proposition.
Explain that. Why is this friction a selling point for a tour?
Because if you go to a place like, say, Venice, you are visiting a museum. The history is done. It's preserved in amber. In Bhutan, the history is happening now.
Mm.
You are witnessing a civilization trying to figure out how to be modern without losing its soul.
Yeah.
You are watching the experiment in real time.
And we try to curate that. We don't just show you the temple. We introduce you to the monk who is struggling to balance his vows with his desire for a smartphone.
We show you the high-value, low-impact tourism policy in action.
That's the daily fee. The sustainable development fee.
Yes. And it makes Bhutan expensive. There's no way around that. But the upside is you are never fighting crowds. You aren't standing in line behind 500 backpackers. You have silence. You have exclusivity.
So bringing it all back to the Dragon Secrets, we've covered the names, the demons, the hidden death, and the happiness index.
It's a lot of ground.
If you had to summarize the mission of this deep dive for the listener, what is it?
It's to shatter the Shangri-La myth. Bhutan isn't a fairy tale. It's a real place with a complex, often violent, incredibly resilient history. It's a land that was tamed by mystics and unified by warlords. And understanding that struggle makes the peace you feel when you are there so much more valuable.
It's not peace by accident. It's peace by design.
Peace by effort. Hard-won peace.
And that leads to the final provocative thought. As Bhutan opens up, as the internet floods in, as the roads get wider, can they hold on to it?
Can the Thunder Dragon roar over the noise of globalization? Or will it just become another homogenized tourist spot with nice mountains?
That is the question, and I think the only way to answer it is to go and see the friction for yourself.
Don't just read about the dragon. Come enter the dragon's lair.
With Best of Bhutan Tours, of course.
We'll be waiting with the context, the stories, and maybe a cup of butter tea.
Maybe sweet tea for me.
We can arrange that, too.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive. We hope we've given you the keys to the kingdom.
Tashi Dilek. Goodbye.